You are entering the Royals Podcast Network.
A show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
Belted to left field. Billy comes through tonight. Splash.
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
And welcome into the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn. I, of course, am your host, Jeff Herr. With me, as always, the indubitable Michael Angelo. I don't even know if that's a word. I do not know if that's a word, but I'm using it. Yeah, I count it for the adjective bank. So, but Michael Angelo with me, of course, as always. Mike, how are you doing this evening?
Cold. I don't like this. It was like Saturday. It was like 70 degrees or something.
Yeah.
And now it's like 20.
You know, I went to the Chiefs game Sunday night. We're not going to talk about the game. We're not going to talk about it. But Saturday, I'm talking to my dad, and he's like, "Hey, you know, we got a email from the Chiefs season ticket holders. Say, hey, you know, make sure you get out there within plenty of time because of possible inclement weather." I'm like, what inclement? I looked at my phone. It was 67 degrees at one point on Saturday. And they're talking about inclement weather. So it sure as hell got cold. There was nothing I would term as inclement weather, but damn if it wasn't cold, and it still is. I don't know if it's been above freezing all day long. So yeah, one of those beautiful Kansas City days, but hopefully it's supposed to warm up by this weekend. Regardless of the weather, warm, cold, whatever, we've got...
It's hot stove season.
It's hot stove season, that is correct.
That's why they call it hot stove season, because...
See, little did you know, that's why. There it is.
Something like that. I mean, I assume it makes sense to me. It
makes sense to me as well. Speaking of which... hot stove season, lots of moves, lots of signing, free agents going places, all kinds of stuff. We'll start with, probably doesn't have the most, it's obvious, I guess it will impact the Royals next year, sort of, but long time Kansas City Royal draftee, Billy Butler, has departed. We all knew he was going somewhere, but now it's official. The Royals weren't able to re-sign Billy for less money. Apparently not, at least anyway. I don't even know if they tried, but it didn't happen regardless. And he ended up signing with the Oakland A's, which was kind of perplexing for some because many people didn't really know, myself included, that the A's were really in the running. I think Texas was a likely landing spot, most people thought. Seattle has coveted Billy Butler for a long time. They had a lot of money to spend. Seemed like he'd be a really good option for them. And, you know, other teams like Baltimore, Tampa Bay, were in the market for a DH kind of maybe slash first base type that could, you know, fill in at first base, play a lot of DH and hit well. And it seemed like those would be all more likely spots, but in comes Oakland. And, you know, I'm not certain how well Oakland's ballpark is going to treat Billy. No worse than the K, I don't think. But I don't know that he'd have a step up and statistically like he would in, say, Baltimore. but it was a 3-year, $30 million contract. So, I mean, technically he loses $2 million, but, I mean, to be paid $10 million for the next 3 years, that's more than he was paid this year. So, I mean, pretty good. Probably, I mean, by most accounts, probably above what the market should have been for Billy. I mean, what does this kind of a contract say to you, Mike?
Well, I was surprised by the amount because everything that I kind of picked up from the Royals, what was reported, not that I know anybody in the Royals, but that they weren't really looking to go more than like 2 years and $12 million total. Like, you know, you look at Butler in 2012, you know, career year, 2013, a little bit down, 2014, quite a bit down. the power really... You know, who knows where it went? You know, it's just something that hasn't been there the last 2 years, but that's also following that peak of 29 homers in 2012. So, you know, it looks like the Royals saw him as a guy on decline and weren't really willing to invest that kind of money, even though he said that he wanted to stick around. And I'm sure they would have liked to have kept him, but it's also the writing's kind of been on the wall since mid-2013 that they were kind of looking at switching it up so that they could be more flexible at that DH spot and use it to get days off for some guys. Sal Perez and maybe a day off in the field for Lorenzo Cain, even though the defense, you get to save his legs a little bit. Things like that. Just, little bit of, half days off where they can give guys some time off to kind of rest just that day or whatever. And they've been kind of looking that way for a while. So when he signed with Oakland, who typically they've kind of been a walk, home run, strikeout kind of team, and you get this guy who doesn't really hit home runs and doesn't strike out that much and walks, but doesn't really walk at an elite level. So he's kind of a weird fit for them, but they were also a fly ball heavy team last year. Butler hits more line drives and ground balls. So I guess that kind of balances their offense in a way, I suppose. But he also hits a left-hander as well, and the A's didn't hit lefties very well last year. So that's, I think, their main thing. But 3 years and $30 million is kind of – it does seem high considering the year he's coming off of. And so I think what the A's saw is that he hit the ball hard last year. And if you look at how he did compared to most, I think he was like a top 15 guy as far as hitting the ball hard. It just didn't really get through a lot of times. So I think they're banking on him continuing to be able to have that skill of hitting the ball hard and banking on better results going forward. So that's pretty interesting. It's also interesting to see how the rest of the market kind of goes from that, because $10 million a year for Billy Butler does seem high. But at the same time, there's always those contracts early in this process and early in the offseason that seem high. And then by the end of it, it kind of seems to even out and settles in as, a kind of a mid-range kind of deal. So I don't know. I mean, I think it's pretty interesting to see. It's weird to see him on a team other than the Royals. And, especially like in Oakland where Moneyball kind of thing, for them to go and give a guy $10 million a year for 3 years, I think that's something they haven't done before in free agency. So for Billy Butler to be the guy, it's kind of weird. So there's a lot of just interesting things happening in this deal. But in the end, it means Billy Butler is gone. And so, for some part of the fan base, they're going to be really happy about that. And for some, you get kind of attached to these guys. He's been in the organization for 10 years. He's been an all-star. He was one of the early guys who signed an extension with under Dayton Moore. And so you don't expect to see that guy go. But, in the end, the production just wasn't there all year. So he had to seek out greener pastures. And now he's in Oakland and he's going to wear green. So,
like you said, it was definitely surprising, and it will be weird to see him in another uniform, different colors. But also, as you said, it's one of those things where I think the A's are, which is kind of odd for them, but it almost seems like they're hoping for some of the things to come through that they see in Billy Butler. And now maybe it's not. Maybe from their perspective, it's not hope. It's something that, hey, we see this skill set. We know it'll play in these situations, and that's why we want him, type of a thing. And we talked about it before. I mean, we had nearly an entire show on the ballot of Billy Butler. And, we think there was I've heard it on the radio a lot, too, ever since Butler got signed by the A's. I mean, this organization jacked with Billy Butler. They just straight up messed with him his entire career. And, I think that's pretty evident, whether it's, passive aggressively talking bad about him in the media, Ned Yost's famous astronaut comment, or, it's pitting him and Hosmer basically against each other. I don't know. I don't know how much the organization actually did that, but, you know, just by the situation itself.
It's how it played out.
Yeah.
It's how it looked from the outside.
Yeah, and you know, the way it was handled in the media made it feel like that as well. But, I mean, it's also, you kind of got the feeling that the organization was putting pressure on him to be a different kind of hitter, because the hitter that Billy Butler is now, you can say his skills decline. Okay, maybe, you know, the numbers would bear that out over the last 2 years, but he's only 28, and usually skills don't decline that quickly. People bring up Butler's body type, but I think that's a non-starter for me, just because you've seen plenty of players with a body type like Billy Butler that can be successful into their, you know, late 20s, early 30s. Not to mention, Billy Butler was 240 pounds out of high school, or 230 pounds, sorry, out of high school. I went back and found a scouting report. He was listed at 232 pounds. He's listed at 240 pounds now. So over the last 10 years, Billy Butler's gained at most 8 pounds, and it's probably mostly muscle. I mean, I know it's just what he's listed at, and who knows how accurate that actually is, but that's all we have to go on, you know, mm-hmm. without seeing him step on a scale right in front of us and seeing the same thing 10 years ago. But, you know, just from the eye test, he doesn't look much bigger year to year. So it's not like he is someone that you see just like fluctuating big time in weight being a concern. You know, I mean, I think that's played up much more than it actually is an issue. So, you know, that being said, I think the hitter that he is now, that you saw, you know, this year and in the playoffs, is not the same hitter that he was when he came up in 2007, 2008. Like, just from my own recollection of seeing him, seeing his approach, seeing his swing, seeing the things that he does, that he tries to do, he's a different hitter. And I think a lot of that, you know, some of it is an evolution of Billy Butler as an offensive player. And I think the apex of that evolution was 2012. But the other part of it is, I think, the organization putting pressure on him to just hit a lot of home runs, hit more home runs. You know, that's what they wanted. They wanted it from everybody, not just Butler. But, you know, I think they expected it from Butler, and they kind of put the idea of, hey, you don't really contribute anything else, so you better hit home runs type of, I'm not saying that's what they directly said, but that's the way it looked from the outside. So to me, I think that really messed with Billy and his approach. And I think that going now to Oakland, that's in a much better situation for him in terms of fostering what his true talents are. And Billy's always been the line drive, gap to gap, doubles type hitter. And the home runs came off of that, you know. And, you know, there was kind of that 2011 – the tail end of 2011, 2012 year was when I think he was at the peak of his hitting power, but yet he was started trying to hit more home runs, and things kind of worked out. And then he continued to just focus on the hitting home run part and kind of lost some of the other hitting part. And then it just all kind of snowballed into, you know, couple subpar years for Billy Butler. So, I mean, that's just kind of my thought on this. I mean, you kind of see it that way, Mike? You see things a little differently, or?
Well, a couple things that I have noticed is that his ground ball rates have gone up since 2012. I don't know if that's a result of trying to hit homers, getting on top of the ball instead of squaring it up, and, you know, just trying so hard that he's always on top of it. It could be. You know, maybe he's just a little bit too fast, something like that. I think that a new environment, he can make better adjustments probably. He's always been kind of a student of hitting. They might give him the opportunity to make different adjustments, and maybe there is a difference in pressure being lifted off of him. I also remember from throughout the season, Andy McCullough would write, and a lot of times it was in you know, some of his chats on at the KC Star, talking about how pitchers have pitched him differently in 2014, and he never really adjusted. So that could be part of it, that, you know, he's been in the league long enough that the book is out on him and he just needs to make those adjustments. But I also remember back in 2012, he, at a certain point, it was a legitimate question of would he pass Steve Balboni's record? And then in August, I don't think he hit a single home run. So I think there was a point in that season where he recognized, okay, I'm hitting home runs. And then maybe he was trying at that stage and, you know, finished with 29, didn't even get to 30. So I think there's something to that. I think it could also just be that I think he's got a good shot to do something in Oakland. They say they're going to bat him fourth and fifth, which I was kind of surprised about. I thought they'd bat him maybe sixth, maybe even seventh, and that might be a good spot for him. But they're going to, you know, put him in a run-producing spot. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised with a team like Oakland that really values getting on base. He could be another 100 RBI guy, even if he doesn't hit 20 homers. So on one hand, the stadium's not going to be great for him home run wise, but I think doubles wise, he could get back into that 40 double kind of spot, you know, 40 doubles, 15 mm-hmm. homers. I don't think that's out of line at all. So I think, you know, more and more, it's not a bad fit for him. It's just kind of a weird fit. Like, it seems kind of like they're, Oakland's kind of, you know, playing it safe a little bit. Like, okay, he's probably going to be able to give you at least this. Like, he's got a pretty high floor, most likely, of what kind of production he'll give you. But he doesn't have a lot of breakout upside at this stage. But, you know, that could all change. I mean, new environments can do a lot for players. And Butler in a completely different spot, maybe it is. Maybe it's just what he needs.
Yeah, you know, I do think it's a good fit, and I mean, we'll see, I guess. You know, I agree with your assessment that he's not going to – I legitimately thought if he landed in Texas or Baltimore, he'd be in the 30-35 home run range, but in Oakland, I don't think that's going to be the case. But I do agree with what you said, that he's probably going to be closer to that 2010, 2011 type Butler, knocking 40 doubles, you know, maybe your 15 to 20 home runs and kind of producing that way. So all the best to Billy Butler. Always been my favorite player ever since he came up. So I'll still be rooting for him unless it directly affects the Royals. Yep. So hope everything works out well for him. Good luck to Billy Butler in Oakland. So with the departure of Billy, the Royals now, I mean, we've kind of talked about this before. They've had some holes to fill. One of the things that we were hoping the Royals might do was sign Cuban sensation Yasmani Tomas. However, the Royals did not sign him, but perplexingly, if that's a word, the Arizona Diamondbacks signed him, and Arizona signing him is not the perplexing part, but that it was a 6-year, $68 million deal, which is roughly $11.5 million a year. So the average annual value for Tomas's contract was less than what James Shields got paid last year and less than what they would have paid Billy Butler. So it's an interesting question of, you know, why weren't the Royals in that mix? That's something they could have probably afforded. And, you know, maybe Arizona would have been more appealing to Tomas anyway. But, you know, by all accounts, the Royals weren't. It's weird because while they were really interested, and then all of a sudden they were just like non-players. So it was kind of weird how it played out like that. But it seems like, and Mike and I were kind of talking about this right before we started recording, but it's almost as if this was just a bunch of media hype. You had, you know, Yoenis Cespedes, and then you had Yasiel Puig, and then all of a sudden it was like, oh, this is the next guy, the next Cuban, just, you know, sensation that's going to take baseball by storm and be just awesome. And I don't almost wonder if during a lot of these workouts and evaluations that a lot of teams saw some things that they didn't like and didn't want to take the chance on it for the money that he was asking. And the Diamondbacks, for whatever reason, decided, hey, he's worth this $11.5 million. I mean, is that kind of your assessment as well?
I think it's something like that. I'm curious how those negotiations went through and, like, what teams actually made offers. He does have an opt-out clause in that I think it's after 4 years he's able to opt out, which that might have been something that other teams may not have been willing to offer. So, you know, that kind of puts something on him to where he's going to get paid those first 4 years, but he can opt out, go get paid, you know, on a bigger contract while he's at his peak, which is something that, you know, I thought would be a good idea for the Royals to do because, hey, yeah, get him for a couple of years. Maybe you're not, you know, keeping him around, but you can get him now, have some impact, and continue the success while you have a lot of these guys like Sal and Eric Hosmer and, you know, others within their window. But it is kind of interesting to see how there were thoughts that he was going to go 7 years, $105 million, and he ends up signing for six and 68, because that's a very sharp difference. That's, you know, $40 million. That's huge. And yeah. I think it was something with Puig and Cespedes really fueling a lot of the initial hype because, you know, the guy does have just that their level of power. But with Cespedes, he's not great defensively, but he's got an arm and there's something there. Puig is super athletic. He's, you know, erratic and crazy and whatever, but the guy is a phenom, and I think with Tomas, it just wasn't at the same level, it seems. And I think when you see a guy where the initial thoughts are that he's going to get this much, and then 29 teams aren't willing to give him that much, and he signs for what he did, I think that does suggest that, okay, something took off in the media discussion, and enough teams saw enough question marks that they weren't going to go for that kind of big deal. What I've read, you know, leading up to his signing and after his signing was that, you know, there were thoughts about his body type and how he might, you know, develop as a defender. You know, he's not great on defense now. And so what is he going to do as he gets older? So that might be a concern that a lot of teams had, especially going for like a longer term deal where they haven't really seen him against American professionals yet. So, you know, maybe it is a missed opportunity for the Royals, but at the same time, it's kind of like, okay, well, I will kind of concede to those other 29 teams that didn't sign him that weren't willing to jump over that 6 and 68. You know, who offered him some other deals, and what teams might have offered him, you know, 5 years in 50 million or something like that. You know, what were some of those ranges? That's what I'm kind of interested in. And what teams just saw him and didn't make an offer at all. I mean, that's another thing I'd be interested in. But, you know, that information usually doesn't pop out from anybody. So I don't know if we'll ever know. But it does seem like a lot of guys cooled off on him. And just like you said, the Royals were really hot on his trail for a while. And then all of a sudden they just weren't. And, you know, maybe that has something to do with asking for more from them because he knows that the stadium or his agent knows that the stadium has home run questions, or maybe it is a preference to play in Arizona. I'm not sure, but you know, one way or the other, the Royals are still in the market for an outfielder, and Tomas is, you know, probably going to hit a bunch of homers in Arizona, and we'll kind of see in 4 years where he's at and what happens there. It's an interesting kind of case study in international free agency.
Yeah, that is definitely interesting, and it'll be because it seemed like with this, with the Tomas thing, that this Cuban thing was kind of just these Cuban players, the hype and everything around them was getting close to starting to just careen out of control. But now this maybe brought it down to earth a little bit, so you don't wonder if how that's going to, like you said, how that's going to not only affect, you know, the Cuban player market, but then all international. It'll be interesting to see how that works. The next, you know, Dice K, or the next Yu Darvish, or whoever that comes over and has, or, you know, the next Cuban player that's available. It'll be curious to see how that kind of thing works out. The Cuban and the Asian thing are quite a bit different in terms of how the players are procured, but all the same, it will be interesting. So, and with that, we got what what are the other big moves we've got here, Mike? We had
the
Red Sox making some moves.
Yeah, the Red Sox went and they signed Pablo Sandoval and Hanley Ramirez, both pretty much within the same day, which was interesting. You know, Sandoval, it kind of seemed for a while he was back and forth. He was going to go back to San Francisco or maybe go to Boston. But, yeah, they signed both of them to nearly $100 million deals each. Kind of the Red Sox have like 17 outfielders now. I don't know what they're going to do because Hanley's going to play left, apparently.
Hmm.
So they also have Shane Victorino and I mean, they just have so many guys. Jackie Bradley Jr. and should be able to name them easier, but whatever. It's December. That's my mulligan. But that just kind of came out of nowhere in a way, in the middle of the night a couple of times. So that was pretty interesting to kind of see those guys go there. The Red Sox really seem like, okay, well, they had a bad year this year, but they're going to just jump right back to it. They still need a lot of pitching, but they're apparently still in on John Lester too. So,
of course, because why not?
Must be nice to just be able to go drop that kind of money on players and not have to do much else. So, those are kind of the big deals. I mean, there haven't been a lot of other big things happening so far. I think Nelson Cruz just signed reportedly. I don't think it's been confirmed yet, but he's reportedly got an agreement on a deal for 4 years and $57 million with the Mariners, which is interesting considering he's not good on defense. He's probably going to be a DH as well. So that market's getting kind of weird. That right-handed DH kind of thing is paying off for some of these guys. So, that's another bat off, but the Royals weren't really in on him. But it also takes the Mariners possibly out of the market for a right fielder too. So maybe that means some of those guys who are out there get signed, or maybe if they do want to sign someone, they trade Michael Saunders, like we talked about on the last show, who's apparently on the market. Those are kind of the big deals. The Royals made a bunch of minor league deals with some guys. They signed Ryan Roberts, who used to be with the Diamondbacks. He's going to be, probably backup third baseman. They've got Ryan Jackson they picked up from the Dodgers, who's basically like a utility guy who can't hit, which
can't have enough of those.
Just gotta have them. Jason Nix is a free agent. He goes hitless in his career as a Royal, so that's fun. They also traded a minor league pitcher for an outfielder, Raymond Fuentes, who was with the Padres, who's basically like a taller, faster, or not faster, but he's a tall, fast guy, an outfielder, doesn't have a lot of power, but he's fast outfielder type, so
yeah.
Fits the mold there. Another thing that they're collecting.
Aaron Crow was traded.
I'm getting to him.
Okay.
We'll get to him. I got a lot on Crow, actually. That was kind of like the big thing that I looked at this week.
Gotcha.
They had to add some guys to the 40-man roster to get them protected from the Rule 5 draft. So Jorge Bonifacio and Orlando Calixte are both on the 40-man. I think expected on those guys. Not a lot of guys that you would really think the Royals would lose. Just because a lot of their talent is really in the lower levels, which aren't open to that draft yet, or the guys who are close aren't really anybody that you'd worry about teams taking, since they have to keep them on the roster for the whole year. Like Matt Fields, the teams probably aren't going to take him, and if they are, well, no big loss. But other than that, the Royals and within a couple hours on Black Friday, they signed Jason Frazier to a really nice deal. They signed him to a contract for $1.25 million for 2015, which, he made more than that last year. Guy with a really good track record who pitched well down the stretch and pitched well in October for him. So I think as soon as the ink was dry on that deal, they were trading Aaron Crow to Miami for a couple of guys. Reed Redman is one of the guys. He's a converted infielder who is a pitcher now, who pitched really, really well in the Arizona Fall League. But he's never pitched above double A, and he's 26 years old. So, I don't know what you're going to see out of him. But, you know, it's intriguing at least. Fastball slider type of guy. The scouting report I read called him an extreme strike thrower, which is nice.
Okay.
Would be okay. They also got Brian Flynn, who's a 6'7" left-handed guy, starting pitcher. Was drafted by Detroit, traded to Miami in the Anibal Sanchez deal. He actually went to Wichita State, so some local flavor there. He was the Marlins' number 6 overall prospect in the 2014 Baseball America Prospect Handbook. So there's some talent there. Good fastball command, good changeup apparently. So, you know, he's probably one of those guys that they stash in Omaha as potential call-ups for, you know, spot starts or long relief or something like that. Probably a better option than, like, Aaron Brooks. Better option than, you know, who else do they have? That's the problem. They didn't have any pitching depth. John Lamb, I guess. Guys like that, you know, if they needed to call him up. So, kind of intriguing. It's nice to kind of get almost anything for Crow, who, you know, you look at him overall and his numbers look pretty good. Former All-Star in 2011, you know, really good seasons in 2011, 2012, and 2013. But the shine is just off the apple with them. And I think the Royals are really selling him at a point where they see him on a pretty steep decline. And so they're getting what they can out of him. And they're really saving money, too, because, you know, they're going to have Jason Frazier basically can fill the same role and is going to make less money than Aaron Crow would have after arbitration. So pretty good deal, in my opinion, to kind of see it. And, you know, we saw last year down the stretch, Aaron Crow was just pretty awful and ended up being left off the playoff roster or left off the World Series roster. You know, spoke out a little bit about that. I don't think that's why they traded him. I think they traded him because they do see a decline in his skills in a number of places, actually. You know, down fastball velocity is down. Hasn't improved his walk rate. His strikeout rate is way down. Ground ball rate is dropping year by year. Inherited runners have gone up every single year. So
basically nothing is trending upward for him at this point in his career.
No, it's not. I mean, he's 28.
Which is strange because it's not like he's super old or
he hasn't had notable injury concerns or anything. And when you look at his first 2 years, he was really solid. I mean, you know, I like to look at pitchers in a couple of ways and give me a pitcher who can strike out guys, get ground balls, and who doesn't walk anybody. And Aaron Crow had two of those his first couple of years. But his strikeout rate has gone down since over the last couple of years. But his walk rate's not improved. So, you know, that ratio's not going well for him. And at the same time, he's not getting ground balls at the same rate. So he went from having 2 out of 3 to 0 out of 3. And you kind of see it with the inherited runners. You see it with, you know, he keeps giving up home runs, but he's also giving up more fly balls. And so it's like when they hit the ball hard in the air, it goes out more frequently than average. His fastball is losing velocity, but he's using it more. So all of these things together really make him look like a pretty iffy guy. And when you consider that he made $1.5 million in 2014, and, you know, let's say you round up on, you know, a 20% raise, he's probably going to make about $2 million this year to be, you know, at maybe average out of the bullpen. So, you know, the Royals save some money and they get some guys who might be able to help him out this season. Flynn especially, I think you'll probably see him at some point. He might be in the mix for like a number 5 starter spot. Redmond, probably not. He might be in double A. They see how he does, jump up to triple A. Maybe he's up a little bit to kind of be the last guy in the bullpen if they ever need him. But, yeah, I mean, Aaron Crow, never really kind of worked out. He pitched well out of the bullpen for a couple of years, but they were never able to get him a third pitch. Never really broke out in the minors. They kind of promoted him just kind of off of a really good spring training, and that was about it. He did well most of the time, but 2014, I think, really, seeing him left off the World Series roster was a pretty big sign that the Royals were ready to move on, especially when you have guys like Tim Collins, who was in the minors pretty much all year and hurt most of the year, made it. Even though he's left-handed, they also had Brandon Finnegan, so it's not like they needed a left-hander. Yeah. So a lot of signs, a lot of signals that they were ready to move on. And Tim Collins is eligible for arbitration. They might not tender him a contract either. So, when you compare some of these guys, the Royals have shown that if nothing else, they're really good at finding guys who can pitch out of the bullpen. Luke Hochaver's around. I'm sure he would be more than willing to stick around in Kansas City for, a nice incentive-laden deal, which is one of my favorite phrases this time of year. And so if they can get him for a couple million with incentives, you're in the same kind of spot where you've got a really good right-handed arm coming out of the bullpen. And, the benefit of trading Aaron Crow is even more because, he's very much replaceable. So they got a couple of guys who have some intrigue to them. It's kind of tough to see Crow go because he has been around and he's, grew up in Topeka and went to Mizzou. So Kansas City was kind of right in the middle of that for him. But at the same time, he's got to perform. And if the Royals don't think he's going to continue, well, there you go. They're going to move him on. So, nice deal for them. That was a good day. They got to basically replace Aaron Crow by re-signing Jason Frazier, and then were able to get something for Crow. So pretty well done for the Royals, and I can't really complain.
Yeah, I agree too. I think my comment on Twitter was, not only am I not upset by the Aaron Crow trade, I actually like it quite a bit. So I think you summed it up pretty well. I don't know that there's really much I can add to it, but best of luck to Aaron Crow. It's unfortunate that it didn't work out, because those first couple of years it did look like he was going to be yet another. After 2011, it was one of those things where you were saying, okay, you're going to have, Joaquin Soria was still in the mix at that point, but you still had Greg Holland, and you had Aaron Crow, and you had Kelvin Herrera, and that was going to be kind of the three. And then you throw Joaquin Soria in there because I think, was it 2012 was when he got his second Tommy John when the Royals cut him loose?
I think that's right, yeah.
Yeah, so at that time you're still thinking you're going to have four premier relievers then, and then basically swap out Soria for Wade Davis. And you more or less – point is, you were thinking, or at least most of us were at the time, that Aaron Crow was going to be one of those kind of shutdown guys, and he just wasn't. And it's unfortunate, but the Royals were able to get something out of him, probably maybe even I'd say they got the better end of that deal. So hopefully he succeeds in Miami, and
yeah, and it's not like he's washed up. Like, I don't think he's going to just disappear, but I think you're going to see him basically around the four range in his ERA. I just don't think that he's going to be a shutdown type of guy. I think he'd probably give you good innings sometimes, but he's going to walk guys and give up homers. And, that's tough to do as a reliever. That's probably not going to get him more than, maybe the sixth or seventh inning for the Marlins. But, maybe he'll figure it out. Like we talked about with Butler, sometimes changing organizations is enough, and there's definitely a reason why the Marlins went and got him. So they see something, and if they see something that they can change for the better, maybe they figure out a changeup and how to get him to throw that consistently. And then his fastball velocity isn't that big of a deal because he has three pitches now instead of just two. Well, now maybe he can be a long reliever. Maybe he can be a spot starter. Maybe he can do a little bit more. So, those are the things that he never was able to really do in Kansas City. And so he basically had to sit on the fastball and slider, and and kind of use that as his reliever repertoire. And, you know, we'll see. I think the Royals want it as well, and especially considering that they have the arms behind him, that it was basically they weren't losing anything in their bullpen and gaining depth within their farm system and a couple of guys who are intriguing. So there's, you know, and I think it can be a win-win, but I think the Royals probably edge it out.
Yeah, no, I agree. with that, I mean, is there anything else really want to talk about? That's kind of, it's been kind of slow, really. I think the winter meetings is what everybody's kind of waiting for.
Yeah.
That's really going to kind of heat things up. So this is kind of a little bit of a lull. The Tomas and the Pablo Sandoval, Hanley Ramirez signings were kind of the big things. Other than that, it's all been kind of peripheral. You had the Nelson Cruz thing as well, which was pretty recent. But yeah, other than those big ones, it's mostly just been kind of small stuff. I guess, well, we forgot the, not that it doesn't really have any impact on the Royals, but Giancarlo Stanton signed a ridiculously disgusting contract.
Huge deal. Yeah.
13 years, $325 million or something. What was the final number?
I think it was 325.
Was it? Okay.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure if it was even more than that. But
that one does have an opt-out after like 5 or 6 years or something too. So it's possible that, you know, they don't really pay that much, but still, it's possible he sticks around through it all too. So
yeah,
I mean, that's crazy. That's a third of $1 billion.
Yeah,
that's
good for him.
Huge. Oh, another signing we forgot about was Adam LaRoche signed with the White Sox.
Yes,
which isn't, you know, wasn't really on the Royals' radar. He's basically gonna fit in that Adam Dunn spot where he might play first and might DH some, and gonna be left-handed power. You know, same old story. There's always that guy on the White Sox. Tomy, Dunn,
yep.
Now LaRoche. It's always that big dude who left-handed power. So, you know, I don't know. That's not really a big thing. The White Sox are also talking about Jeff Samardzija, but I don't think that's... Oh, you know what? The big trade that we didn't talk about that I just remembered, should have remembered this, was Josh Donaldson to Toronto.
Oh, that's right.
For Brett Lowry and some prospects. That's interesting. That's kind of like, that goes back to the A's and their philosophy of, you know, not really hoping, because, you know, from that article that we brought up back in the summer that was written by Joe Posnanski, you know, their idea is that they don't go into the next season assuming that this guy and that guy are going to repeat their performance. They look at, you know, the overall skills and what's most likely. And so I think in this case, they're trading a guy who's 29 in Donaldson, who the last 2 years has been one of the top most valuable players. But they're trading for Lowry, who's 24, plays same position, can play some second. He's just been hurt all the time. But, you know, elite defender, kind of an asshole, frankly, from all accounts. but, oh well. But has some power, you know. So it's like they're getting younger and they're getting a guy who's on the upswing towards his peak rather than a guy who's at his peak and coming down. So that's kind of an interesting move from their perspective. Plus they get, you know, all those prospects. So it's almost like they're staying somewhat in place. Their organization overall is stronger, but their current roster might not be. But they're still, you know, they're going to be a pretty good team, I think.
Yeah.
But that was an interesting trade too. So,
was.
You know, I kind of like, you know, Toronto gets to go for it, and really, you know, they're maybe one more acquisition away from being a pretty big player in the East. So
yeah,
you know, that's the season. It's pretty fun to watch. I'm just kind of ready for the Royals to go out and, you know, replace some of the guys that they've lost now. And
yes. And you know what type of an organization would do that, Mike?
Well, what type of organization would that be?
An organization that is the best organization in baseball as voted on by Baseball America, right?
Yeah.
Yes, Baseball America. Which brings us to our next point. What a segue there, huh?
That's a segue.
That's one for the ages right there. But yes, the Royals, we'll kind of finish up with a couple points here. The Royals it came out today, Baseball America has bestowed the honor upon the Royals of the best organization in all of baseball in 2014. So, and I think it's, it's, I don't know if it's necessary. I mean, obviously the Royals had a lot of success going to the World Series, winning the AL pennant. And I don't know if it's necessarily as much about that as much as it is kind of a culmination of where they were when Dayton Moore took over and then getting to, you know, one run away from the highest of the highs.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, it was a great and fun year, as we've talked about, you know, ad nauseum since their epic run there. But, you know, congratulations to the Royals. I hesitate to say much deserved.
Right.
I'm still kind of euphoric from the World Series thing. So that's what first pops to my head. But then I kind of hold back because I'm like, well, a lot of it was kind of lucky. So we'll see before I start talking about how deserving the front office is of those kinds of awards. We'll wait and see if this is a sustainable thing. And what, as you said, you know, waiting for the Royals to come out and make some moves. We'll see what they do the rest of the offseason, how they do next year, if they can keep this rolling or not before I, you know, we start bestowing these, you know, one of the best won organizations in baseball. But at this moment, they won this award from a legit baseball publication, so congrats to them.
Yeah. Last time they won it was 1994. I think Rainey was the first guy who I saw point that out. They went on to have 17 losing seasons over the next 18 after that. So we'll hope that doesn't happen again.
Yes. And finally, another thing, this is completely minor, but I saw today, and Mike, I saw you tweeted this. I actually saw it from your tweet, but the Royals will be switching all of their season tickets now to completely electronically.
Yeah.
So for the 2015 season, where you can either get it scanned on your phone, they said, or you can print it off at home and bring it in, but they're not going to be sending physical tickets, which I'm on the fence about this just because the Chiefs did this a couple of years ago. Personally, I collect my ticket stubs, movies, games, concerts, whatever, because I'm weird like that and I like it. But I know there's a lot of people that do that as well. So it sucks that you missed that aspect of it. But at the same time, it's like it's super convenient. There's no more – like everyone has their phone with them, so it's never a oh, crap, you have the tickets type of thing.
Right.
It's just a, you know, I've got my phone, I've got the tickets. I don't know, maybe they have an app and you download it and you can just pull up the game and it shows your ticket barcode and all four tickets you have or two tickets or one or whatever, and you just scroll through and boom, 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 and there it is. So from a convenience factor, it's nice, but the memento factor, not as much. But then again, you can print it off at home, so it's not much different than buying a ticket online. But
I think Mellinger followed that up by finding out that if – and this might only apply to season ticket holders – but if you ask them for physical tickets, they will send them.
See, you know, and I was talking to my dad, because my parents are season ticket holders for the Chiefs, and I was like, the Chiefs should offer an option like that where, like, hey, I want to print these season tickets, so my season ticket bill is going to be $20 more so that I can pay for these printed tickets.
Uh-huh.
And, like, you know, you can still use your little card, like the Chiefs season ticket holders have a card. You can still use your card, but then you just keep the stubs.
Uh-huh.
So if any really memorable game happens, you can be look at this. You know, there it is.
Yeah.
But so that's really cool. I hadn't heard that part yet. So that's pretty cool that they offer that.
Yeah. I always print them out at home, but I think if I was a season ticket holder and like in 2012, in order to get All-Star game tickets, I had a partial season ticket. So that was nice to have. It was, you know, 41 games, so it was nice to have those in one, like, folder, basically, you know, rather than having to print each and every one of those out. So from a season ticket holder standpoint, I get it. I get why you would ask for that. But for me, you know, I printed out every single ticket that I got. So, but I'm sure there are going to be some people who are going to be very vocal in their complaint just because a lot of people like to complain for – anything, basically.
Right.
Because, you know, it's America and it's their right, dang it.
That's damn straight. So with that, I think that's all we have today. It's like I said, kind of a short news. So hopefully once we get these winter meetings out of the way, all the GMs meet up, talk about things, have some time to assess the market. Maybe some things will happen. We'll have some more stuff to talk about.
Sorry to interrupt you, but that was something that I thought about earlier today. I think Dave, the guy who runs Clubhouse Conversation, another Royals podcast that was out there over the season, he said something about, you know, to those people who are complaining about Dayton Moore not making any moves, would they prefer he makes bad signings? And that made me think about years past where Dayton, you know, he within a week of the World Series was making a trade, you know, was signing guys very early in the process, and he hasn't done that. And that's kind of interesting because we saw it with like Bruce Chen and others where he was just out ahead of everybody before some of the market had settled in and before you could kind of see where the ranges were going to be. And so that's kind of interesting to see right now where, you know, they're not making any moves. They're not making, you know, a lot of big deals. You know, when they did trade a major league player like Aaron Crow, it seems like they got a pretty good group of guys for him. Whereas, you know, when they were trading David DeJesus and whatnot, they were getting, you know, just kind of iffy guys. So, yeah. You know, I wonder if that's just a product of the actual environment or if that's something that he is distinctively decided to do differently. Or, you know, probably column A, column B. But, yeah. You know, that was something earlier this afternoon that I thought of that I was like, oh, yeah, yeah. Because so often he would go out and give Bruce Chen 2 years and, you know, $5 million a year.
Right.
And when it worked out to other guys who were probably as good as or better than Chen were getting less later on in the year. And so it really looked like an overpay and maybe a hasty move up front. So that's, you know, I guess if that means that they're making better moves and using their payroll more efficiently, I guess I can handle waiting.
Yeah. I will agree with that assessment. So, you know, we'll see what other moves he has. Hopefully there's at least one big one that's going to have some impact that we can that we can use to kind of see if that'll have an impact on next season. But until that comes, and we will be there for it, until that comes, I think we're going to leave you tonight. So we talked about it being possibly a short show, and we're actually coming in under an hour for the first time in a long time. So, yeah. All right. All right. Well, with that, this has been the Kansas City Baseball Vault brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn. Thanks for stopping in. I am your host, Jeff Herr. With me, of course, was Michael Engel. So stay tuned for all your Royals news in the offseason. And as always, go Royals.
So look, you've got a ton of places in Kansas City that you can go to. And I wrote out this elaborate script that was going to convince you all why you needed to go to Kelly's. But then I thought, it doesn't need to be that complicated. What do you want? You want a good night out with friends. You want cheap drinks. You want good food. What can be better than beer and pizza? You've got Joe's in the back. You've got drink specials every night. And if you're not at Arrowhead tailgating, you got the Chiefs on Sundays. So tell me, what can be better than that? Do you need flashing lights? No, you don't need that. You don't need to spend $70 on a night out to impress a date? No. You go out to where the bartenders are going to recognize you every time you show up in an old building that has a lot of character in a great district of Kansas City. It's that simple. Don't overthink it. Just go to Kelly's Westport Inn.
You have been listening to a Royals Podcast Network presentation.